the latest box office numbers.
Our revenue has been trending down for years.
It certainly isn't the quality of our product. Piracy is killing us.
So how do we reverse this trend?
We could try telling your stories again.
Seriously, though, we should continue to make movies that appeal to the broadest possible audience. Any suggestions?
Earn, Hollywood, earn. Our revenue is going down. Need a hit that will not bomb. So let's remake a movie. Update a classic film just to prove we can take an old idea and just revise the plot and characters how we like. Cause all we care about is not selling out and front loading the box office rollout. So we never stick our necks out. Our film's no test audience checked out. Hollywood and Woodchuck Wood, how much would you chuck just to make a buck? But some films we'll never remake. There's no limit to what we'll take. For all the years we worked so hard, the work is over, time to steal with no regard.
Similar plot and cast would be safe. Tell the same story in a different place. Blockbuster box office just like the other. Don't mind the critics, another bucker.
As a channel surf from naked night to TV land, thinking how hard it can be to adapt one of these classic TV shows of Darren's and Ralph's, Luke's and Bo's. Many would pay and cheer with glee to see their favorite show up on the screen. All you really need to do is change one thing or two. Shoot the whole thing like a damn music video, and old actors of shows adapted as a playing the lead part. Not gonna happen. Cameo is the perfect role, even if since they've gotten old. So let's steal some ideas from old works. Seems the best way to keep jobs and perks is nothing that we can't regurgitate to earn. Earn, Hollywood, earn.
Or Woody Allen, right?
Well, it's a featured adaptation of Perfect Strangers starring Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson.
Say what? Screw this, I'm on.
Hey, we need to brainstorm for ideas for our next feature. What do you got?
I think we should return Blue Thunder to the big screen.
What about Apocalypse Later?
Knott's Landing could be a feature. Keep the 80s style and juxtapose it with a modern word.
I know, we can update Dr. Strange while it cast Steve Martin.
Hold on, I've got it.
Ladies and gentlemen, tonight's feature presentation, Welcome Back, Carter.
You go, Carter!
It's gonna be great.
Moving the whole thing to L.A. and casting Ice Cube.
Brilliant. We should have Gabe Kaplan make a cameo as the janitor.
Burger King coins from this are going to be incredible.
I love Hollywood, man.
That was Earn Hollywood Earn by Possible Oscar. You're listening to episode 552 of Unwelcome Guests. Now we return to Richard Stallman discussing how digital rights management, DRM, is created by a conspiracy of companies.
It's normally set up by a conspiracy because it takes a publisher and a technology company. It's rare that one company is in a position to do this by itself. Thus, Amazon is working with publishers. That's a conspiracy. The DVD manufacturers work with the movie companies. It's a conspiracy. And how do I know about this? Well, I am not an investigator, and if these conspiracies were secret, I wouldn't know how to drag them out in the open. But in fact, these conspiracies are not secret. They have websites. For instance, I visited the AACS website to look at the gigantic file that describes the rules that they impose on everybody in the conspiracy. And I saw that as of a certain year, it was either 2011 or 2013, they were going to forbid analog video outputs. They are quite arrogant, and they believe they're entitled to and can get away with dictating every aspect of the technology to be made available to us. I believe that a conspiracy of companies to restrict the technology available to the public should be punished like a conspiracy to fix prices. The executives of those companies should go to jail for that kind of thing. but they are fully aware that our governments are on their side against us. They don't even need to hide. They establish these websites describing their conspiracies to attack our use of technology. And if you look at the AACS website, you can even find which companies launched the conspiracy. They included Intel and AMD and Microsoft and Apple and IBM and Sony and Philips and Disney. A lot of malicious companies. So the Free Software Foundation has established a campaign of protests against DRM. It's called defectivebydesign.org. Go to that site and you can sign up to participate in our protests. Right now we're having a protest of sending email to Sony to condemn its sending the police against the people who figured out how to run their own programs in the PlayStation 3. The product was originally sold with that feature. And then Sony gave people an upgrade saying certain features are going to break unless you install this upgrade, which takes away that feature. Look at how arrogant that is. So people figured out how to break that upgrade so that they could go back to installing the GNU plus Linux system and whatever other software they want in these machines as they were supposed to be able to do. And for that, the police are persecuting them. Go to defectivebydesign.org and sign up. Help our protests. If there are enough of us, we can defeat those bastards. So the laws that support these vicious companies against our freedom are the sort of thing that governments have actually been doing. Governments which are subservient to the megacorporations. Governments which have, in effect, betrayed their countries. And, of course, you can see that betrayal in lots of other areas as well. But what should they be doing? What would a democratic government that aims to defend the freedom and well-being of the citizens do in copyright in the age of the computer networks? It would reduce copyright power to something that we can live with. Here are my recommendations. First of all, there's the dimension of time. I recommend the copyright last for 10 years, starting from the date of publication of the work. Why from the date of publication? Because before publication, we don't have copies. So it doesn't matter whether we would be allowed or not allowed to copy the copies we don't have. We might as well let the author have as long as it takes to arrange publication of the work and then start the clock. Why 10 years? Because the publication cycle nowadays is around 3 years. Most works are remaindered within 2 years and out of print within three. So 10 years is more than three times that. It's comfortably long. So I think it will be plenty. But not everyone agrees. I once proposed these same recommendations in a panel discussion with fiction writers, and an award-winning fantasy writer responded, 10 years, that's ridiculous. Anything more than 5 years is intolerable. Yeah, I was surprised too, because until that moment, I had naively believed what the publishers said when they claimed that it was for the sake of the authors that they demanded more copyright power. I didn't realize that that was a typical 10% truth. You've heard that a half-truth is worse than a lie, but business tends to make 10% truths that are even worse than a half-truth. There's just barely enough truth in them that you can't call it an out-and-out lie. But mostly it's a lie. And one of these 10% truths is we want this power for the sake of the authors. And, of course, there are a few superstar authors that they treat really nicely and that get a lot of money from this system. And they're a handful, and they're supposed to, they trot them out and present them as examples of how the system treats authors. And meanwhile, the rest of the authors are being ground into the dust with the heels of the publishers. Like this guy who, despite having won an award, his book was not a big hit, and it had gone out of print. Maybe it was multiple books, I don't know. One of them won an award. I'm not sure if he had others. In any case, they were out of print. His fans wanted to get copies and couldn't. His contract said that when the books went out of print, the rights would revert to him. But the publisher refused to acknowledge that they were out of print. It pretended they were not. And as a result, the publisher was using the copyright on his own book to stop him from distributing copies, which he wanted to do so people could read them. He wanted people to be able to read his work and appreciate it. That's what just about every artist starts out wanting. And a few of them get it a lot of money, like J.K. Rowling, and get corrupted by it. And they start wanting the money more than wanting people to appreciate their works. And they start begrudging anything that would lose them any money. And by the way, I still urge people not to buy Harry Potter books. I don't say don't read them, only don't buy them. The reason is that the author told people don't read them. The author and the publisher in Canada got an injunction against people who had been sold copies by mistake, ordering them not to read the books that they had been sold in the bookstore. Well, if she's going to tell people not to read those books, I'm just going to say don't buy those books. You can find a page about this on Stallman.org. Well, that shows how artists can get corrupted when they are one of those few that get a lot of money. But the author who was objecting on this panel hadn't been corrupted. He still wanted people to appreciate his work. And that's what most artists continue wanting. So only a few who get enough money that it could corrupt them. So he realized that more than 5 years of copyright was not likely to ever do him any good, but could do him harm. And he said, no more than 5 years. Well, I'm not necessarily against that. If everybody wants 5 years, I won't argue for 10 instead. I propose 10 as a rough idea of a first adjustment to make. I think it's in the right range. Let's try it. Partly it's just I'm being a little more conservative. There's no need to be more radical than is necessary in the situation. But then there's the other question, the dimension of breadth of copyright. Which uses of copyrighted works should copyright cover? Here I distinguish three categories of works based on what kind of contribution they make to society. There are the works that are used to do a practical job. There are the works that say what certain people thought. And then there are the works of art and entertainment whose contribution is in the impact of the work itself on the mind of the reader or listener or viewer. Three different kinds of contribution that lead me to different conclusions. First, let's look at the functional works, the works that whose contribution is they help you do a job. These include programs, recipes, educational works, reference works, text fonts, and various other things that you could identify. These works must be free. The same arguments that apply to software apply to the other works that you use to do a job. And they are if you're doing the job, you deserve to control the job, and that means you need to have control over the work you're using to do it. So you've got to be free to change it. But once you've changed it, then you should be free to publish your version, because there may be other people who want to do the job the same way you want to do it. And your change would be useful for them. So you've got to be free to publish that. But it's absurd to allow publication of modified versions and not allow republication of without change, because that would just make people make some changes that don't really affect anything so they could be allowed to publish. So we end up with the same four freedoms. All these works should be free. And that's how far my ideas about software extend to other things. They extend to other works that are like software in that you use them to do jobs. Someone might respond, but we can't possibly insist on freedom. If we demand freedom, they'll never make the works and we'll have nothing. We've got to surrender. 20 years ago, I couldn't have proved they were wrong. I could only have said, what use are those works if they take away our freedom? I don't want them. But now we have empirical evidence that he's simply wrong. If we look at the free software community and the tens of thousands of useful free programs, we see that, yes, people will make these works. And then look at all the recipes that people circulate treating them effectively as free. And then look at Wikipedia. We see that great free reference works will be made. And even in education, we're starting to see free textbooks. All textbooks ought to be free. Free in the sense of freedom, of course. And since it is governments that ultimately pay a large fraction of the cost of writing these textbooks, they could just dictate that they will be free. They don't have to allow publishers to make them proprietary. They could say, we're not going to spend money that way. We're going to pay people to write free textbooks, and then the schools will redistribute them, and we won't have to worry about that. So we now see that when you insist on freedom, you don't have a disaster. What you do is you get works and you get freedom. So in this category, the works must be free. But what about the second category, works that say what certain people thought? For instance, memoirs, essays of opinion, offers to buy and sell, scientific papers. A scientific paper is actually a work of testimony. It says, we did this and we saw this. We are the ones who testify to this. It's very important to have the author's names on that paper, because those are the ones whose reputation is at stake if they lied or made a mistake and didn't see what they thought they saw. With these works, to publish a modified version would just misrepresent someone else. There's no social contribution in that, so I don't see any reason why it needs to be permitted. Therefore, I recommend a somewhat reduced copyright system, which would cover modified versions. And once you're going to say you can't publish a modified version, there's no particular reason to allow commercial publication at all. So copyright could cover all commercial use of the work. But there is something that everyone must be free to do, and that is to share, to non-commercially redistribute exact copies. So copyright can cover all commercial use. It can cover all modification, but the freedom to share must be respected. And that's the minimum freedom we must have for every published work. And the reason is, to take that freedom away from people is what makes copyright a cruel, draconian system. It's the war on sharing that leads to suing teenagers for hundreds of thousands of dollars. It leads to unjust laws that threaten to cut people off from the internet. And consider how absurd it is to talk about improving broadband coverage in the UK while attacking people for making use of broadband in the way it's mainly useful. Why even bother to have broadband if you're not going to let people share? But sharing is good, and sharing fits human nature. So any war on sharing has to be cruel and nasty. And a government that wouldn't enter on such a war is clearly a government of occupation established by the empire of the megacorporations to exploit the citizens it rules. So we must end the war on sharing. We must legalize sharing. But we can still have copyright on commercial use of these works and on modification. And thus, this copyright system would continue to provide more or less the same meager income that artists mostly get from the present system. This system would function in about the same inadequate way as the present system, with a few rare exceptions that serve to misrepresent the usual reality of the present system. What about the artistic and entertainment works? For these, the issue of modification is difficult, because I see valid arguments on both sides. On the one hand, a work can have an artistic integrity, and modifying it can destroy that. And I think that is true, although the artists are much less concerned with artistic integrity than they lead us to think. Just see how most of them will gladly let Hollywood butcher those same works in exchange for enough money. Well, that's not artistic integrity. But there are some who won't let Hollywood change the work and do violence to it. So I guess those are the artists that have artistic integrity. But on the other hand, modifying artistic works can be a contribution to art. Consider the folk process, which people are basically not allowed to take up any further. But the folk process, where a series of artists transform a work, can produce something very rich. But if we want to consider only named authors, consider Shakespeare, some of whose plays copied stories from other works that were just decades old at the time. If today's copyright law had existed then, those works would have been considered infringing. He would not have been allowed to stage them or publish them, so they wouldn't have been written. And if he or Henry Neville or whoever it really was that wrote them had complained, then the copyright holders would have said, "You just want to make a cheap ripoff of my work." Well, because those works were written, people can say they're important literature, not cheap ripoffs. But if they had never been written, it would be hard for people to think about the question, and there might be a tendency to unthinkingly believe what those copyright holders would say. So there are arguments on both sides, but what occurred to me is a modified version of an artistic work can contribute to art, but you don't have to be in a hurry. You could wait 10 years and then publish your modified version. If copyright lasts 10 years, you can afford to wait 10 years at most, because maybe the work was 5 years old when you saw it and you only have to wait 5 years. With today's copyright law, you may have to wait longer than a lifetime. But if copyright is short enough, then you can wait that long. So that's what I recommend for these works. For 10 years, the reduced copyright system that covers all commercial use and all modification. And then when the work goes into the public domain, you can publish your modified version of it, which might be another contribution to art. However, there's one other point we need to consider, and that is remix, which means taking snippets of various things and putting them together into a work that overall is basically different. And that just has to be legal, because the purpose of copyright law is to encourage making new works. If it impedes making new works, that means it has been distorted so much it goes exactly against its purpose. And that has, in fact, happened with the publishers being allowed to distort the system. But if we want to serve the stated purpose of promoting the arts, we mustn't allow it to be distorted so much. Ending the war on sharing means legalizing file sharing over the internet and ending all the various things that are being done to try to stop it and punish people who share. So you'd be free to share music on the internet, and you wouldn't even need the special peer-to-peer programs. You could just put it on your own website or whatever was convenient to do. The record companies would make all sorts of exaggerated claims that, like, this is stealing from the musicians. That's not true. You can't steal what somebody never had. And the record companies don't generally pay the musicians, so there is no way that you could take any of what they were going to pay to the musicians. There is, theoretically, when the record company sells music, theoretically a certain part of that price is for the musicians, but they never get it. Because the production and publicity expenses are counted as an advance to the musicians, according to the contract, and therefore that fraction goes to repay those expenses. And it is extremely rare that a record sells enough copies to finish repaying that so-called advance. So the musicians don't get any money if you buy their record. When I buy commercial CDs, which is the main way I get music, I am always a little ashamed of failing to support the musicians. But what can I do? Now, this is not to say musicians get no benefit from a record contract. What they get is the benefit of the publicity, which means more people will come to their concerts and they'll have more concerts. That's an opportunity to actually make some money. But they could just as well get their publicity in a different kind of system. It doesn't have to be a system like that of the record companies based on stopping people from sharing. We can give people, we can give musicians publicity by sharing their music. And that will give them the same benefit for their concerts. And you might wonder, would movies still be made? After all, you've probably heard gigantic figures for the cost of making a movie. But actually, more than half of that cost is publicity rather than actually making the movie, according to a producer I spoke with. And not only that, but even before that, the cost has been exaggerated using creative accounting measures, because the higher they the figure they can give for the cost, the less they have to pay in taxes and to investors. So the real cost of making the movie is much less. Now, put that together with the fact that a lot of use of movies is commercial use in theaters, broadcasting, in airplanes and buses. It's all commercial use. It would be covered by my proposed reduced copyright system. And I think that, yes, movies could still be made. They might not always be the same movies. They might be better. But Hollywood systematically produces crap. I say systematically because it's not that they always try to make good movies, except it's so hard that they almost always fail. Rather, the system leads them to try to make movies that everyone knows are going to be lousy, but they might make money. I read a book called Save the Cat, which says its purpose is to teach how to write screenplays that will sell. I wasn't interested in that, but I read the book because the book explains also, it explains the system which, as it happens, ensures most movies are going to be crap. Now, that doesn't mean they shouldn't be allowed to do it. Censorship is the most disgusting thing you could find in the arts. And all censorship is intolerable. I mean, censorship on any grounds whatsoever is an attack on our freedom. The UK practices a lot of censorship. People face imprisonment because they uploaded a video showing that they had burned a Quran. Well, that's an expression of an opinion about religion. I don't know if I'd express it the same way, but I feel sort of the same way about all religions. But so what? The point is they have a right to express that opinion. They didn't hurt anybody. They weren't burning a person. And it was their publication of this that they are threatened with imprisonment for. And recently in France, I've heard of people being sentenced and others threatened for verbally stating opinions. Now, I don't agree with those opinions, but censorship is a threat to everyone, and we have to defend the freedom to express opinions we disagree with. So I would certainly be against trying to censor movies because they're crap, but that's not the issue. The question is rather, should we give up our freedom to help them keep making more crap? And there I say no. They can make all the crap they want, but that's not an excuse to hurt us. However, supporting the arts is a good thing. And we might want to support the arts better than the current lousy system we've got, which supports a few superstars very well and supports most artists hardly at all. I have a couple of suggestions. One is to use taxes to support the arts. Now, you could have a special tax on internet connectivity, or you could get the money from the general budget. It doesn't really matter where the money comes from, because it won't be a lot of money. And what I suggest is to distribute this money directly to the creative people based on their popularity, meaning not based on bureaucrats' decisions, based on measurements that can be made through polling and sampling of those who are willing to participate, but not in linear proportion. Why not? Suppose Superstar A is 1,000 times as popular as fairly successful artist B. If you give the money in linear proportion, that means you've got to give A 1,000 times as much money as B, which means in order to give B enough to live on, you've got to make A very, very rich, and that uses a lot of taxpayers' money. It's using the money inefficiently because for our purpose, which is to support the arts, we don't need to make him rich. So I suggest applying a function like cube root. I'm not saying cube root's the perfect function for this. It's an example. It looks sort of like this. Well, the cube root of 1,000 is 10. If we use the cube root to adjust the raw popularity, then A having 1,000 times as much popularity would get 10 times as much money as B. Meaning that we could give B enough to live on if we adjust all the basic parameters such that people like B get enough to live on, then people like A, yes, they'll get more, but not so much more. And most of the money will be going to support a lot of artists in the middle range of popularity, meaning we'll be using the money overall in an efficient way. That's one method. The other method is voluntary payments. Suppose each player had a button you could push to make an anonymous voluntary payment of perhaps, say, 25 pence to the artist that made the last work you played or the one you're playing now. And you could do that if you want. But nothing tries to punish you if you don't. It's entirely voluntary. A lot of people will do it because it's not a lot of money. I think all of you could afford to push that button once a week and maybe even once a day. Of course, there are some people who can't afford that, who are poor, and they will never push that button. And that's as it should be. We don't need to squeeze money out of poor people to support the arts. There are enough non-poor people who will be happy to do so. So we can leave it to them and let the poor people alone. Now, voluntary payments are already supporting artists. Many artists have set up ways that people can voluntarily give them various amounts of money. And they typically will provide some token gift in exchange. Like, for $200, I'll send you a CD in a very pretty case, which I've signed. But this is not a real purchase. The market value of the thing that's being given in exchange is much less. It's really mostly gift. And this works pretty well, but it's only feasible for much larger amounts of money. Because with today's payment systems, which, by the way, are not anonymous, they're not very efficient. For a small transaction, the artist will only get half the money anyway. So these larger amounts of money you might hesitate to give because they're enough money that they might make a difference to you. What I'm saying is, for the very small payments I'm talking about, the main reason anybody wouldn't pay is not because of the value of that money, but rather because of the effort it takes. So let's get rid of the effort, and people will start sending it. And if we would like people to donate more, we could have a publicity campaign. Instead of the cruel and nasty publicity campaign that says, sharing is theft, if you share, you're a pirate. We could have a friendly PR campaign. Have you sent 25 pence to some artist today? Why not? If you heard or saw something you really liked, wouldn't you love to give something back and help them do more? Push the button. And people would do this because they'll feel good, because this is bringing up the best side of human nature, and people who let that influence them will feel good afterwards. So they'll want to do it again. So that is my talk. For more information about free software, look at GNU.org. You can also look at the Free Software Foundation's website. That's at fsf.org. There is also the Free Software Foundation Europe at fsfe.org. And both of those organizations would appreciate if you join. You can join either of them through its website, which involves paying dues, because both have paid staff. Now, I'm not part of that. I'm a full-time volunteer for the FSF because, as president, I want to set an example of volunteering. But we have paid staff, and if you join, you help support them. There are also various campaigns of political pressure. For instance, there is defectivebydesign.org. Please join that.
So this is quite reminiscent of episode 534 on planned obsolescence. And why should companies be interested in the lifetime of their products or the environment or anything other than the amount of money they can extract from people in a short space of time? The point to me, of course, that we need to change from the money system we have to something which is a better reflection of what people actually want. Only last week I read a confident opinion that Bitcoin will be declared illegal by national governments who see the threat of a money system out of their control. In terms of free software, I've been running free software for a few years now and I've never looked back. If you'd like to switch over, it might be easier than you think. Just go to ubuntu.com, that's ubuntu.com. You can download a CD which you can try out without changing anything in your existing computer. In terms of digital handcuffs, to show you some of the things that may be going on if you're having closed source commercial software on your digital device, Apple iPhone users have recently found out that their position was being logged so many times a day that was secretly being recorded to a file that was transferred on their home computer and then hidden. Now, of course, this was not done without some people's knowledge, and security companies said, oh yes, we do that, we write software which allows the powers that be to analyze this so they know where you were. And then, of course, it turned out that Google Android was doing the same thing. And why can we be surprised at this? They were probably offered lots of money by the powers that be. And this is the same Google which has quite an extensive profile on your searching habits. And if their car has been in your neighborhood, probably they know a bunch of details about your Wi-Fi network. And they apparently accidentally recorded a few gigabytes of information, basically everything they could get their hands on. And now they're going to court all sorts of countries trying to say, well, we don't actually have to give it back just because we took it and it was illegal. And if they say they've given it back, well, I'm not going to believe them. I don't see why anyone would. Anyway, here are some questions and answers. I had to trim this. If you want the full version, you can download it, of course, from this show's website, unwelcomeguest.net/552.
What do you think about patent when it comes to that?
I don't want to talk about patents today because patents and copyrights have nothing to do with each other. And if I talked about patents today, I would be supporting the widespread mistaken idea that they are similar. They're not similar. They're totally unrelated. Why would anyone ever confuse them? It's the fashion to confuse them, to lump them together. There is a fashionable term, quote, intellectual property, unquote, which tries to generalize about a dozen or more different laws, copyright being one and patent law being another. Well, these laws are totally different. They have nothing in common. And it's any statement formulated in terms of, quote, intellectual property, unquote, is confusion. So, but that confusion has influenced many people. And they see other people using this term and they think, this is the way we're supposed to speak today, so I have to use this term too. And as a result, they make their statements vague. I want to be careful not to encourage that mistaken practice. I have given a talk about copyright law. I've said a number of things that relate to copyright law. They don't have anything to do with patent law. Patent law is a totally different topic. And I'd rather not talk about it today because then people would think they have something to do with each other.
Basically, I'm not sure whether I'm in the loop or not, but I believe that following the DMCA, there was certain attempts by a senator from Utah, Orrin Hatch, to tighten the screws even further.
They keep tightening the screws in the U.S., and not just there. In Europe, there's a wave of laws authorizing governments to shut down network servers without even a trial. So there are lots of different things, that nasty things that have been proposed as tactics in the war on sharing.
Okay, but the core of my question is that you say that a lot of this comes from influential business, and sort of what I want to ask is, what's the inertia? Do governments, when given these proposals, do they carry them out fairly autonomously as democratically elected benevolent systems, or do they require external force to...
Well, I don't know the details, and it probably varies, but in the U.S. government, the Congress people and senators need lots of money to run for re-election, and indirectly they get this money from business. And there's a well-developed system of lobbying where they know who's going to get them the money that they'll need, and they know what they have to do for those businesses in order to get it, which means, although I have no basis to assume that they're doing this in a way that's illegal, but the laws, you know, that laws forbid certain things, they know how to skirt those laws and effectively be corrupt.
Is it fair to say during your talk, you referred to some talk written as megacorps and the terms bastard as well? I don't know whether you relate to
that. That's, I don't remember when I said that. I think I was talking specifically about companies that convinced our governments to make laws to attack our freedom in order to help them.
So when you say megacorp, is that because you feel they're too big, or do you have...
Well, the bigger they are, the more political influence they have, typically.
So it's more because the way they interact with the political and citizen community sphere.
Well, that's what's bad. That's what I'm criticizing.
Yes.
Now,
yeah.
Calling them... The term megacorporation just refers to their size.
Yeah. Is it in general you see that, you cited a few that started conspiracies, as you call them, but do you have any example of non-conspiratorial megacorps that you feel is beneficial?
I don't know.
In
general, I think that it's dangerous to allow such large companies to exist, because they get power by being so large, and then they make threats against governments. And you can see the effects of that around the UK right now. So they were able to make a financial crisis. I guess you see it even worse in Ireland now. Companies made a financial crisis, and the people are going to pay. So why is it that the people are going to pay? It's because powerful entities said, we won't let you make the depositors in these failed banks pay. Of course, you know, it's good to insure deposits of individuals up to a certain point so that they don't become impoverished. But beyond that, why should the people have to pay the debts that these private banks had contracted? Well, they were pressured, the government was pressured, to do something that was going to hurt the country for a long time. But you can see over and over policies that benefit business in various different ways at the expense of people generally. And business can do this because it has political influence. And the bigger businesses get, the more political influence they have, they get to be considered too big to fail. Well, any business that's too big to fail threatens us all. So we need to make these businesses smaller, like make them split up into multiple businesses that are not so big and they're not too big to fail. That's one solution. There are various ways to achieve this. The point is that in our political system today, when people talk about a problem, the people talking about it mostly want a certain outcome, and they mention the problem as an argument for the outcome they want, which usually is more subsidy for business, less regulation of business, people in general being trampled more. And so they mention that the business is too big to fail when it's in danger of failing. And the rest of the time they don't say, this business is too big to fail, we're having reasonably good times now. Let's do something to make it split up so that if anything were to go wrong in the future, it wouldn't be too big to fail. And it wouldn't cause us a big problem if it does fail.
I'd like to ask you a question about what we as an audience and all the rest of the members of the public can do to actually practically make this stuff happen. So would you say that at the moment, as copyright is as it is, creatives and people producing works should actually go for things like the Creative Commons licenses and...
Yes, but you can do more than that. For instance, keep your Wi-Fi networks open. Don't be conscripted into being an enforcer in the war on sharing. Collective responsibility is a favorite tactic of tyrants. And various governments are trying to pressure people to put passwords on their wireless networks so that everybody's kept divided and everybody can be kept under control. By having an open wireless network, you resist. Now, if somebody else is using so much of your bandwidth that it's hard for you to get work done, I understand you've got to do something about that. But there are various things you can try to do. Just putting a password on it permanently could be the last resort. And sometimes, if your neighbor is really obnoxious, you may need to do that. But maybe you don't need to do that. Maybe talking to your neighbors would be enough to avoid that and solve your practical problem. So give it a try. Think of this as a form of protest. And I think that alternative voting is also important for this, because that would enable people to much more effectively express their support for a political party that says, we're going to end the war on sharing.
Great. And could you actually point to, is there already a project to do micropayments thing you were talking about?
I didn't talk about micropayments.
Well, you know,
a quarter of a pound is not a micropayment. It's a small but substantial payment. Micropayments are, the term micropayments usually refers to something different, yeah. Namely compulsory payments that you have no choice about. I'm not in favor of that, because that's part of a system of DRM. So please don't call this micropayments and give people the wrong idea. But the technology for things like that exists. The hard part is getting it adopted. And I don't know how to do that. I can only propose it as an idea.
Okay, I shall go. Are you suggesting that I should go and search myself rather than you actually give me a name of a project?
I don't have any name to give you any.
Flutter.com.
What?
Thank you.
Flutter.com.
Well, that's something somewhat similar in that it's also a project to make it easier for people to voluntarily give to some artists. So in its general spirit, it's similar, but in the details, it's different.
Do you think it's a danger that a lot of computers are being hidden behind terms of appliance? So, for example, an ebook reader is not sold as a computer, and therefore users don't expect to be able to do the things which it can do, which they would otherwise expect if it were, say, a desktop. And the same with phones and with music players, which are locked down, but which
Wait. First of all, a lot of phones, this is a complicated issue, and what you said is not entirely true. First of all, there are some things which are appliances which happen to be built using computers, and or maybe they're built using computers, and maybe they have software in them, but it makes no difference to us. And I don't see that we need to be concerned about that. Then there are other things like smartphones, which are general-purpose computers, and users are installing software on them all the time, and I think users are more and more aware that they are general-purpose computers. So I would rather describe that by saying this is another kind of general-purpose computer that users are using. And then there are things that are sort of on the boundary, where it's possible to install software in something, but it isn't the normal use. And I think it's just barely okay to think of those as appliances. But some of these devices are malicious. That's a separate question from whether they are computers and you deserve free software in them and deserve to be able to change the software any way you like.
It's not about this. The computer or the software is about the freedom to use it as you...
Right, well, the point is some of these devices are malicious and they're designed to restrict what you can do. And that's nasty, whether the device is a computer or an appliance or whatever.
The type of device is irrelevant if you haven't got the freedom to...
Yeah, and my point was that users a lot of the time are, I would say, duped into expecting less from their device as it's marketed as an appliance.
That's buying the wrong device, then.
Maybe. I'm not sure. I tend to think of that as a side issue, and I don't have strong opinions about it. If they're really being lied to, well, it's not good to lie. But on the other hand, the fact that there is a processor chip in something, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily bad that processor chip is being put to doing one specific kind of job, and it's not the job of running programs for you. To be a general purpose computer is not about how something is built. It's about what job it does for you. A general purpose computer is a platform for installing programs to do lots of different things. And so that's different from an appliance. And so they may have the same processor chip. In other words, I'm saying this distinction between what is presented to you as a platform for running programs and the appliance is a real difference, even if they have the same processor in them. But malicious appliances are just as nasty as malicious computers.
My question is regarding, because in most of the universities that you mentioned, people teach the proprietary software, like languages, from Microsoft, maybe some other companies as well. What could be done to let the universities throughout the world know the best way for them to teach their students is through the the free software?
It's not easy. Of course, in my free software speeches, I explain at greater length the reasons why education should only teach free software. But if you're asking, practically speaking, how do you succeed in getting them to change, there is no easy way. You have to organize and keep organizing more people and teach more people to demand this, including students, including faculty, and always present the issue as an ethical one. If they try to make it be about just practical things, you have to say, no, the question here is, what's a good or a bad thing for a school to do? And working together with the allies you found, you'll keep looking for new ways, and you might succeed, because some people have succeeded in some places. But I don't know. I wish I could tell you, follow these rules and you'll succeed, but it's not that easy. The point is that the Free Software Society should explicitly say this university should not teach proprietary software. It's wrong to do that. And most of the free software organizations that exist right now don't go that far, and they need to go that far.
A welcome encouragement from Richard Stallman there to do the right thing. My prediction is for a lot more such encouragements and a lot more people having the courage to act on them. It strikes me that the war on sharing is a kind of digital equivalent of the war on drugs. It's another victimless crime that people engage in, and it's used by governments to roll back a bunch of laws about people's rights and freedoms which they find inconvenient. This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive, which is unwelcomeguests.net/archive. The music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all of